The following was produced by Pirate Radio Studios, Incorporated.
Before we get started, I wanted to take a special moment here and tell you about our friends at Central Barbecue. They are our brand new sponsors from Radioland. Those of you that live in Memphis are familiar with Central Barbecue's delicious Memphis-style barbecue. There's just no way to describe it. There's three locations here. You know all about it. And those of you that don't live here and you're sitting there going, well, thanks for teasing me, bro. Look, you can have their barbecue delivered right to your door, no matter where you live here, anywhere inside the USA. Barbecue ribs, pulled pork. Oh, my God. This stuff is tremendous. Combo pack, seasoning, sauces. You got a party coming up. You want to do something a little special one night? Hop online. Order you some of this barbecue. They will deliver the taste of Memphis right to your dinner table. It's just that simple. Check it out. Radio-Memphis.com. Look for the banner ad that says Central Barbecue. They're here for you. If you've ever been to Memphis and had some of this barbecue and you go, man, next time we come back to Memphis, we're going to have to get some. You don't have to worry about all that now. They will ship it straight to you. Find it online at our website, radio-memphis.com. Look at the top of the page. There's a thing that rotates through all the different banner ads up there. Click it that says Central Barbecue. It'll take you straight to their store. Get some today. All right, let's get started with the show, huh? My name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland. Greetings, salutations, hello, hey, how's it going? Welcome to another episode from Radioland. It's the show that loves to talk books and music, which is kind of what we've got going on today. We had a really cool moment on the air the other day with our new friend, Mr. Robert Gordon. You can find him online at therobertgordon.com. A great cat, just a tremendous writer, filmmaker. He's done documentaries. He's got a brand new thing. It's in theaters now called Best of Enemies. It's the story of William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal and the discussions that those two had. And more famously, he's the author of a fantastic book I highly recommend called Respect Yourself. It's the Stack Records and the Soul Explosion. It's a good look at the history of the music that came out of Memphis at that time. Robert came down to the radio station while we were we had a recent episode of Booze and Blues on the air. We recorded that conversation and we had a great talk about the sound, the Memphis music sound. Wanted to share that with you. So kick back, relax, enjoy it, learn something about music. We play a few tunes in here too. So we got started talking about the book, and this is how it went.
We did a ton of interviews, and there was, you know, in the film we could only barely scratch the surface of. Right. What we wanted, actually, this was the issue they had.
The train.
When they opened up the studio in out near Raleigh.
Yeah.
The train tracks ran right by.
Right.
And they said we got to get somewhere else, and they wanted to move into town anyway. And
yeah.
It was the train that would come by and be like, "This is a good take." Oh no, the train.
Yeah, that's been somewhat of an issue when this was a studio as well. If we keep those doors closed, it's not so bad. But we're down right. In the basement, and it's only like 50 feet away.
Yeah. I didn't think about that.
But yeah.
So I had all these interviews that were rich with information and a story that where I felt like all the dots had never really been connected, and the narrative of what happened at Stax was still there to tell. And so I thought, oh, I've got these interviews done, and they're transcribed. This will be easy. Like 4 years later,
done. Yeah, you're still going through it.
But it was a blast.
Did you find that when you were going through that process that there were, you know, if you've got 20 people involved in the story, there's 20 different versions of what
mostly,
really happened?
Yeah. At least 20. If there's 20 people, there's at least 20 versions.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was something I picked up in writing from Peter Guralnick in his book, Sweet Soul Music. It was like, you know, I wasn't there. We weren't there. So there's no harm. My job is twofold. One is to figure out what happened, and the other is to tell what might have happened. So someone's version, you know, I might have the Steve Cropper version of what happened, and then follow that with the Al Bell version of what happened, or the Booker T. Jones version of what happened. It's okay, you know, in the storytelling to give the different perspectives.
Well, sure, yeah.
An issue, you know, when I was writing, I wrote a book about Muddy Waters, the blues singer, and yes. And there was I was in this moment of crisis in that book when I was trying to figure out whether Muddy had, let's see, he'd moved to Chicago, and then his grandmother down in Clarksdale on Stovall Plantation mm-hmm. had died. Mm-hmm. And so did he go back and get the car then? Or, you know, it was like this issue that I realized I had, you know, two very reliable sources, and they told opposing stories. And I was like, okay, this is the Muddy Waters story by Robert Gordon. So I'm going to make the decision here to go with this one. And in the back of the book, I'll say, you know, the other possibility is that it went like this.
Right.
In the notes.
Yeah.
But in the main text, I'm going to go with the one that seems like it makes the most sense to me.
You look for the most plausible explanations for some of these wild stories.
Plausible, not maybe not, but you know, the truest.
Yeah. And I guess with Stax, that's what you had to do, because there was a lot of a different... I mean, this is a very difficult time for Memphis anyway for that to have existed.
Right.
You know, with everything that was happening with the racial segregation and the desegregation, everything was starting to come to play. And here you got a couple of white people that have made this studio, and black musicians were all of a sudden this as you put it, the explosion of this sound that came right out of that spot had turned everybody around.
Yeah, and I think the key there is that it was the context in which it all was happening. You know, it was all happening as one thing, and then the context in which it was happening really made it a profoundly powerful story. The defiance of racial protocol,
yeah,
in Memphis and the nation at the time, and the casual way that was done. So that was all I wanted to, you know, set the story in that context. And you know, I'm born and raised here. I felt like I was real educated on the history. And it was during that book I realized there's more. You know, I knew about the sanitation worker strike in 1968, and I remembered it, actually. I was seven at the time, and there mm-hmm. was like a couple things I specifically recalled. And Booker T. Jones had told me in an interview with him that when he was a kid, his father taught him to shake hands with the sanitation workers. And like that just stayed in the back of my mind for months and months and months. And I finally realized, oh, that 68 event was one event in a much longer saga. I bet there's more to this story than I know. And I went and got the Tri-State Defender mm-hmm. on microfilm and put it in at the library. And like practically the first headline I looked at from early 1960 said, and Mayor Loeb, who was in office during the sanitation strike, was in office in 60 as well.
Right.
And the first headline was like, you know, sanitation workers threaten strike. Loeb at City Hall is irate. You know, it was like it could have been 8 years later.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I was like, okay, let's get into this. And that turned out, because all that was going on the whole time that Stax was happening, it was a great way for me to ground the story, the Stax story, in the social history of the time.
One of the stories that I've heard, and I don't know if you got into this in the book or not, but, you know, right around the time that when King was assassinated, of course, that was, what, April 64, I think it was.
68.
And then you've got this upheaval in the city right around that time for about those 10 days after. Mm-hmm. And you had these
and those 10 years after.
And those,
and the 10 years after that.
And up to 2010, 2015. The business at Stax continued, of course. I mean, you know, they were still making music. There were still a lot of things going on. And there's a story in there about how there were black musicians that were giving rides to, like, Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper, white guys, riding with them to get them into the studio. And they would have to, they were going through these
well, actually, these rides, it was to get them out of the studio.
Oh, it was to get them out. It wasn't to get them in. It was to get them out.
Yeah, because...
And it would say, hey, they're with us. It's okay.
Exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what happened. And they closed the building down for like a week after the assassination.
Okay.
And so it was people who were there had to get out, because it all happened, you know, at the crack of a rifle. And
right.
Things changed instantly. And Isaac Hayes was given rides to get people out. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just
it's a fascinating idea to think that actually occurred here, you know, at that time. Mm. When you go back and you listen to that music and you hear the political influences that came from some of that, you know, that really shaped a lot of that music, and the real soul, the sound of the city really came alive right there.
There's a great Staple Singer song from like 67, I think, Soul Folk in Action, mm-hmm. CD or LP. It's called When Will We Be Paid for the Work We've Done. I don't know if you've got it in your
I don't have that one.
It's
no.
But it's a great song that really captures the feel of the time, because it applies not only to the sanitation workers, but all of the people who were doing the work and not getting paid or not getting properly paid.
Yeah, we still see that today, that politics shape music.
Yeah.
And you've got musicians who are trying to shape it back, you know.
Yeah, yeah, you know, exactly.
One of the ideas that I use, and especially with some of our younger listeners, is the incident that occurred in Russia with the punk band Pussy Riot.
Right.
You know, they were out there trying to make a political statement, and they wound up going to jail over it.
Right.
And you think about that for a second. You're willing to go to jail for your rock and roll, you know. and here it's a little different. It's like, you know, you see the things that are happening in the world, whether you're anti-war or anti, you know, politics or, you know, whatever. The music just seemed to, I don't know, reek of that, and it's you know, I think it's its own form.
Mm-hmm.
In many aspects.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing is when the music itself, not the lyrics, but just the music is capturing that crossroads, that meld. And that's kind of what happened at Stax. You know, in my first book, It Came From Memphis, I talked about, like, the white guys in the 50s mm-hmm. trying to play black music, and they couldn't. The failed attempt came to be called rock and roll. You know, it was like an attempt to play black music. Yeah. They couldn't do it. They did something else, and that wound up having its own merits.
Yeah,
you know. And so, but I love, like, you know, like, you know, the MGs are the perfect example of are the perfect example of styles coming together. You have Steve Cropper, who's trying to sound like Loman Pauling from the Five Royales, and play, you know, he wants to be is an R&B guitarist.
Yeah,
you know, and Duck the same. You know, Duck's dream was to be on King Records, where James Brown had recorded, and then you have, you know, but they're white, so they have their, and they've been raised in a white church where they'd sort of gotten their musical background. And so it's sort of like,
that's straight 1-2.
It's an accent.
Yeah,
you know, it's like you come from Boston, you have a Boston accent. You come from Chicago, you have that Chicago accent. You know, so that sort of made these guys unable to be exactly what they were trying to be, but to be something altogether new in their own right.
Yeah, the sound that you know, just what Booker T and the MGs did, I mean, not just the fact that they had backed just about every act that came out of there, and you don't think about it when you're listening to, you know whoever it is, whoever's singing, you don't think of that as Booker T and the MGs back there,
right?
But when you hear their music and that, you know, the instrumental stuff that they laid, you know, you hear Green Onions or Hip Hugger and all that stuff, you immediately know that sound, and that's because they had, you know, had devised their own feel, their own.
Well, I think in that whole first period of Stax, their chameleon-esque way to subvert their own personalities to back the vocalist also creates, there's a instantly recognizable sound there, you know, for Stax up till 67, 68, when they're largely the house band, mm-hmm. you know, and on most of the sound. You can hear a record and go, you know, I don't think I've heard this record, but this sounds like it must be Stax 65.
Right. You know? Well, Memphis in general has that. And you and I were talking a little bit about this very thing. Is it, not in these words, but I can hear a band and go, that's from Memphis.
Mm-hmm.
Even a current act, that's working. You can hear a band from one of the shows that we have here is a show called Around the World, and we actually feature music, indie music, and you know, lower talent from all literally all around the world. And you can hear them going, "We're fans of Memphis. We want to get in on that sound." And they'll emulate that to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, you guys are getting it pretty close, and you can tell they got an ear for it because they've been listening to stuff like Stax or anything that came out of Sun Records prior to the Stax explosion. Mm-hmm. You know, so the influences are pretty stout.
Well, that's what I was telling Robert before we started. One of my favorite artists currently is Frazee Ford, and when I listened to her, I said she's unmistakably Canadian, but the horns on her album are Memphis.
Yeah.
And it was later that I heard that Robert actually had a hand in having her come to Memphis, and she was backed by the High Rhythm.
Yeah.
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 So I definitely agree. You can definitely tell that.
Yeah, yesterday the High Rhythm section was working the Cooper Young thing.
Yeah.
Did you go down there?
I did not.
Yeah, Otis Clay was singing with him. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I missed it as well. I'd like to have seen that.
Yeah. I've seen them back him, and it's, you know, some of his best albums, they're the band on there backing him, and there's a real simpatico between him and them. I wonder who was on guitar. Michael Tolles, maybe.
I
don't know.
Yeah. And I guess it was Howard Grimes playing drums. I think.
Yeah, was, Charles yeah. Hodges on organ.
Oh yeah.
And Leroy on bass.
Then let me ask you this. Then what? And I've asked a lot of these guys the same question. What defines that Memphis sound? Where does it come from? You know, is it
comes from here?
Yeah, I know. I mean,
it's
you
in
know,
the water.
It comes from Memphis. I mean, is it?
It's the barbecue in the air.
It's the barbecue. It's the water. It's the air. It's the humidity. It's the heat. It's the cold. It's the.
I don't know
what it is.
I think it's. I mean, I think what it was. You know, now there. Now it's sort of hard to say that one place is different from another,
yeah.
Because everything is nationalized, you know.
I'd say we're different than New Orleans.
Yes.
Or St. Louis, yes, even, up
fair
and
enough.
Down the river, yeah.
Fair enough. So, yes, those distinctions can still be made.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a time when, you know, everyone that you would hear on your radio or TV sounded like you instead of sounded yeah. like a salesman from... you know, far away.
Yeah.
So, and it was, and when you could, all the food around you was food that was made with local ingredients, because that's what it was, you know. Cajun food was, you had to go to Cajun country to get Cajun food.
Sure.
You know, and so there was a sense of, there were regional personalities. Hell, I mean, 38104 was different from 38103 or
sure, yeah.
117. I mean, and, you know, Rena Laura in Mississippi was different from Clarksdale and all that, but
yeah,
you know, things like MTV, things like the fact that, you know, we've lost that sense of local.
It's homogenized.
Yeah,
you think,
yeah,
you know?
The nationalized nature of it.
To a certain extent, we'll hear bands like, there's that obvious Midtown punk sound.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's that North Mississippi blues, of course. You have that
right.
Eastern Arkansas angry rock and metal that comes out of there, you know, and there is some of those slight regional differences. But when you talk about, you say you take one style of music, whether it's soul or rhythm and blues or, you know, that true Memphis sound, and it's got the horns on, everything's going, it's like, what, you know, what is that? What is this? What is going
so,
on here?
So I think in part what it is, you know, and to a degree still, Memphis is the, you know, it's the golden glow on the horizon in the distance. It's the place. We're still surrounded largely by rural area. And
mm-hmm.
and when people want to go to the city, they come here. You know, that's where, pardon me, that's where we are. We are the distant big city away.
Right,
so
right.
On the street, you know how a cricket rubs its legs together to get a certain sound.
Mm-hmm.
So on the street here, when you get this mix of rural and urban, you know, people coming from out away and people here, and you, especially back in the day, cotton time, when you had, you know, rich and poor and black and white, field hand and cotton baron all
right.
walking on the street, the way the shoulders rubbed, you know, was, I think, what produced that sound. You had on one street, you could have this conflagration of lots of differences in a single place. And so the sound came from that. You could hear on a corner, you might hear the Five Royales, or you might hear Louis Jordan, or you might hear some hillbilly, act, the Delmore Brothers or whatever. Because people of such difference were all in one spot, they brought all these different things with them.
Yeah, it's sort of like everybody being influenced by everybody else in a
in a
positive way,
in a crossroads way.
Yeah,
I mean that's what. So I think in a way it's there's a geographical reason.
It's almost like a perfect match, everything that kind of came, from everybody that was coming up and down the river at the same time. You know,
they had to come here. It wasn't the reason it happened here and not in Clarksdale or not in somewhere is because you had a. This is where the market was. You brought the cotton here.
Yeah.
So everybody came here.
Yeah. That is a great story of Robert Johnson, who passed out on a train and woke up and thought he was in Chicago and wrote Sweet Home Chicago and realized he was in Memphis.
Well, I remember in high school when I started hearing those Robert Gordon rockabilly records, I think I heard Billy Lee Riley through those records. It's like, hearing... learning about Otis Redding through the Stones, or that kind of thing. It was like, oh, wait a minute. This is very, wait a minute. This is Sun. Okay.
Yeah.
You go backwards.
You go backwards.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great. And I think many of the great artists have been songhounds at heart, I mean, they're great artists as well, but they're songhounds and they find these great songs and they just want to share them with people, their own version. Often similar, similar, different to the original, doesn't matter, I just like that. Then you like it and you dig a little deeper and you find out more on your own. It's a great way to get exposed.
What attracted you to the subject of Stax in the Memphis music scene? Was it just being a fan, a casual fan, and listening to it, but I want to know more? Or
basically, I mean, I remember as a kid Rufus Thomas doing commercials on, local commercials on TV.
Yeah.
I knew who he was. The way it got personal was seeing the Rolling Stones at the Liberty Bowl Stadium, 1975 or 7. I can never remember which side of the bicentennial it was on.
Yeah.
And Furry Lewis opened up. It was outdoors on the 4th of July.
Wow.
And it was hot, and it was so hot. And to steal a line from Jim Dickinson, Mick Jagger didn't want to go on until the sun went down because he didn't want his makeup to run. But that's because he mistakenly thought it was going to cool off when the sun went down.
It gets worse sometimes. Yeah.
So to, help quell the anxious crowd, they brought Furry Lewis on.
Wow.
And I remember I had my back to the stage and I heard just the sound of his fingers on the strings and you could hear the boniness in his fingers, and everything was very immediate. And I whipped around. I was like, I was too far back on the field, but too far back to really be able to see what was going on. And within about a year's time, Furry played during lunch at my high school.
Yeah.
And so I went to the older, I was like, how'd this happen? And in short order, I had his phone number and I called him up from the school phone. I want to come over. He said,
he's like, yeah, come on.
Yeah. He said, come on. And, I said, what can I bring? He said,
a pint of whiskey and a carton of smokes.
pint of 10 high bourbon.
Yeah.
And a hamburger from Wendy's Raw. I was like, Furry. So when I went in there, when I went in there to order it, they said, I said, okay, yeah, put it on there a little bit on each side. Let's make sure it's not poisonous.
Did
so
he eat it?
Yeah.
Oh. I'm surprised somebody at Wendy's went, oh, it's for Furry, isn't it?
Yeah. Maybe it was for his dog or something. That's what.
Oh yeah, a pint of 10 high and a Wendy's raw burger.
So, but I started, I kept going back at that point. And it was every time it was a revelation, and there was that whole sense of his life in that duplex, not but two blocks off of Poplar, but over near where the psychiatric center was, yeah. where Le Bonheur is now. And it was, you know, last time I went over there, it's been a number of years, but I kind of every now and then I'll wander over there just to soak up the memories of, and yeah. and the duplex has been, it burned while he still lived there, it burned, I remember, and the one next to it still stands. It's very similar. Last time I was there, I was talking to a girl who was walking by, and she said, all right, well, let me go, you know, she had a crack rock in her hand. She said, well, let me go do my rock. I was like, see you later.
See ya. Okay.
But the whole thing going on there then was so different from my life out east. And
sure.
it was connected, and I was aware this is, you know, the this is the blues, and I'm getting more here at his feet than, you know, I can ever get on a record. And
right.
and then it wasn't until I moved away for college that I realized how special that had been. It was very mundane here, you know. In the beginning, the hard part was, it wasn't hard to buy the whiskey. I wasn't old enough to drive.
Right.
But I could buy the whiskey, but I couldn't get a ride, you know. And so by the time I moved away, I began to appreciate how so much of that was different from what other people had experienced in their high school.
Was he pretty forthcoming about his story? I mean, a lot of these guys were pretty guarded, you know, especially when you had seen some of these artists that had been ripped off so
right.
much by recording people and record companies and just worked to the bone until they dropped dead, and, you know, but
for me at the time, you know, as a teenager,
yeah,
I would bring a tape recorder to record sometimes, but, you know, in my early documentarian days,
yeah.
I wouldn't always buy fresh batteries.
No.
But, you know, but and Furry's concern, Furry would always say there was a game show on at the time called The Price is Right, and Furry would always say, well, you can record that, you know, but you know the show The Price is Right, we got to make the price right. So basically he wanted to, if I wanted to turn on the tape recorder, he wanted me to give him, you know, $10 or something, and
yeah.
and I would do it, and I found these tapes, you know, decades later, and it's like, oh yeah, you know, should have bought batteries.
Should have bought some batteries. We need to digitize those and get them corrected for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, right, you know? Right, right.
I bet they're just real gems, though, to listen to.
You know? I mean, there's a great, I'll see if I brought it here. There's a great Terry Manning recording. Oh, I think I was looking for it and couldn't find it. Great Terry Manning recording. Wait, I bet there's a track of it on here. It's a Furry Lewis CD called Fourth and Beale.
Mm-hmm.
And Terry went to Furry's. When I went to Furry's house, he was at 811 Mosby.
Yeah.
And his prior place had been Fourth and Beale, where, what is there now? I don't even know. I think a hotel.
There's like that, the big white, it's like a senior citizen's.
No. This was.
Wait, Fourth and Beale. Like where the Hard Rock is now?
I believe that this building was in the parking lot of the bus station.
Ah.
And so.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so it wasn't actually Fourth and Beale,
yeah,
but that was just kind of
the known, general area.
Yeah. There's a great photo of Will Shade, who was the. Who was a great mm-hmm. player in the Memphis Jug Band.
Right.
A photo taken by William Claxton, a great jazz photographer. He came through here and took some fantastic black and white photos. It's in a book of his. I remember being at the library one day just kind of flipping pages like, whoa. But that gives you a great sense of what Fourth and Beale was like.
Yeah, Will Shade and those guys with the Memphis Jug Band, that was an institution, really. I mean, you had guys that had, you know, I think, I don't know if Handy was involved in any shape of it, but these guys have been around for, you know, since the 20s and into the 30s, and then they kept going up until probably nearly the 40s or 50s.
There's a Ferry Lewis on their track five.
Okay.
That is gives a sense of what it was like. I mean, it was very comfortable. It was like every time Ferry had come up playing medicine shows, so he was an entertainer, right. You know, and he knew how to keep a crowd, and that's kind of, it was no problem for him to play, and you know, the whiskey was flowing, and
sure,
he always, there was always like three ladies from the neighborhood hanging out at Furry's. it was shocking, really cool,
right? Yeah.
Small little duplex over there, and it was funny, I never went in the back. It was like you walked in, and there was a like bus station sofa on the right, his bed on the left. He had lost half a leg in a train hopping accident as a kid. So a lot of times he'd just be sitting up in bed with his leg off. He had a string that he'd connected so he could turn on the TV from his bed. He couldn't turn it off because he couldn't push the string. You know,
he could pull the knob out.
Yeah, exactly. And then there was like a room beyond that had a kitchen and part of a wall kind of thing. You know, like I forget what they call it, apartment style kitchen, or there's a term for it. And
like an efficiency type of kitchen. Yeah,
efficiency type kitchen. Like, and so I never went back there. All the times I went there, it was like, you know,
stay out of there.
Yeah. The ladies with the wigs on, they'd go back there, but...
Oh, my. Avril. let's give it a listen.
Going to Brownsville.
Oh, yeah. That was a great classic right here. Well, yeah, here it is, Mr. Furry Lewis.
Going to Brown, take that right-hand road. And I'm going to Brownsville, moon, take that right-hand road. Until I get my baby gone. And that woman I love ain't got great long curly hair. And that woman got great long curly hair. Mother and father, do not lie me there. I'm gonna write me a letter, I'm gonna mail it in there. Gonna do what you time. Stay here, can stay most everywhere. And my first name, Furry, I ain't gonna tell my second name, baby. And my first name, I ain't gonna tell my second name. Treat me low down dirty shame. Asked my baby for cabbage and she brought me a ton of green. Asked my baby for cabbage, she brought me a ton of green. Boy, and I asked for water, brought me gasoline. I'm going down, down, I'm going on down the line, baby. And I'm going on down, down, on down the line, baby. If I don't go crazy, Lord, I will lose my mind. And sometime I feel like saying, Nero, my God, to thee. Sometime I feel like Nero, my God, to thee. Sometime I feel like saying, say that again, Todd. Nero, my God, to thee, baby. And you know it didn't warn me when you lay down across my bed. You know you did not warn me when you lay across my bed. Drinking your white lightning, talking all out your head. Got a letter this morning. Listen how she read. Got a letter this morning, boy, listen how she read. Crying, come home for a rest. Woman, you love it dead. And I caught a train and I went back home a flying. And I caught a train and I went back home a flying. My woman won't dead, but she was slowly dying. But I know some of the oldest songs it is.
Yep, there you go.
Furry.
Furry. It's an unmistakable sound.
So when you would sit with him in his duplex, would he play for you?
Yeah.
And he would just
I quickly learned. I mean, Furry made it plain how it worked. You bring him whiskey, you bring him money, and he'll sit there and play. And then so one of the tapes I found that I had fresh batteries in, I had brought these. I'd met these people from France on the street downtown. I was like, "Yeah, come on, we'll go over to Furry's house. They're, you know, I'd love to find those people today and hear what they thought of that whole incident, you know." And and Furry wanted to send out for a gallon, you know, of whiskey. And I remember I was driving then, so I was 16 or 17.
Yeah,
and I was like, I was a cheapskate, you know. I had like $2 in my pocket, and so I put up $2 in the French guys. I don't know what, but on the tape, you know, it becomes apparent that there's not enough money to get very much whiskey. And Furry says, you know, I got the rheumatism today. I can't play.
I was hurting,
and you know, when I heard that, you know, decades later, I was like, You know, that I was learning a new language is what it was. I was learning how things work.
Yes. Yeah, it was the barter days.
Yeah,
that was
absolutely pay to play. Damn straight, you know. I mean,
oh well, yeah.
I you know, admonished myself in my long distance past for not having bucks in my pocket and forking them over to him.
Yeah, because you know, you
usually I did.
Yeah, well. Going into the situation, you wouldn't really necessarily think about that. You may have heard stories that some of these cats would be like, yeah, you know, look, if you're going to go see him, go, you know, take $20, you know.
Right.
And, you know, buy him a sandwich, you know, bring some whiskey, and you've got him for an hour, you know.
Right. Yeah, he had this great deal where the way he would get paid a lot of times was he kept his guitar in the pawn shop. So if you wanted to hear him play, you had to go get his guitar out of the pawn shop.
Oh, wow.
And then when you would bring him home from the gig, he'd put his guitar in the pawn shop because then he'd get paid twice. He knew someone was going to want to hear him again.
Oh, wow.
And so the way he could be sure to get paid was he'd get the pawn shop money as an advance on the next gig. Mm-hmm. And then
somebody else would pawn his or get his guitar out of Hawk.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually kind of smart.
Yeah, totally, man. Totally.
Well, I wonder what it was like to record with the guy, though. I mean, like in a you know, like to make that record, you know, in a professional recording environment. Well, I mean,
you can hear on that one, Furry's sitting in his bed playing, and Terry's got two mics. It's just Furry and his guitar, and Terry recorded it at 4th and Beale in Furry's apartment, and you can hear Furry kind of shift from the spatial microphone placement. You can hear him move
from
around,
one side to the other. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pretty neat.
That is. Oh, that's awesome. You don't just work in the world of books. You also work in video.
Film, yeah.
In film and video, yeah. Yeah. And on your site, one of the first things that popped up here, of course, at the top is the Best of Enemies that
yes.
you're working on. William F. Buckley and Gore Vidal. This is along the lines of the Frost Nixon type stuff, isn't it?
It's not dissimilar, although it's extremely dissimilar. It's
I mean,
it's two guys, two intellectuals sitting around talking.
Yeah.
Here the stakes. Here it's a discussion. It's a debate, virulent debate about politics. And our film is really about the media associated with it. Sort of how TV was affected by this and.
Yeah.
Which is these two guys were
with reality TV. This was just featured on NPR.
Yeah,
a couple weeks.
It's
ago.
It's been in theaters. It's still in theaters now.
Yeah.
It's kind of on the end of its theatrical run. Opened in a few cities Friday. Still opening in cities, but has been come and gone to a lot of cities. But it was great to so much of the stuff I've done is music oriented and. Mm-hmm. All the music stuff I do is to me never really about just about the music. It's everybody is a metaphor for something else. The Stack story is a civil rights and integration and race story. Muddy Waters is a story about the African American migration north and the cultural collisions in Chicago that occurred. It came from Memphis. You know, I did a Johnny Cash film, and it's really it's called Johnny Cash's America, and it's really about America. It's about the principles of America through the lens of Johnny Cash. I like that because it was in one film we featured Al Gore, Lamar Alexander, Snoop Dogg, Ozzy Osbourne.
Oh, wow.
Others. Yeah. It's like, that's what Johnny Cash was, and that's what America is.
Yeah, it is. You know? Yeah, I can see where you're going with that.
So, but they always get tagged at, you know, they get binned in the music section, which automatically, I've learned, many, you know, much of the people I want to see it don't see it because it's not in the history section or it's not in the... politics section or media section.
Oh, yeah.
So this movie, Best of Enemies, about the 1968 debates between Vidal and Buckley and its effect on TV has had a much wider audience, and that's been really cool.
I met Vidal one time. Interesting dude.
Tell me your story, and then I'll tell you mine.
I was working in television at the time. It was in television news, and it was about the time I think his book Lincoln had come out, and he was doing his press junkets for all of that, and the meeting. He just seemed sort of not necessarily holier than thou, but you know he put himself on that. You know, I am Gore Vidal.
Yes, he was he thought quite highly of himself.
You are here because of me, you know. And it wasn't narcissism per se that I got out of it. It's just that he anticipates himself is a good way to look at it. And but at the same time, he seemed rather gracious and very polite,
charming. He was a man who had a certain charm that he could turn on and off
to a business-like point. I don't know that I describe people sometimes as, you know, this guy sounds like he'd be a great guy to have a couple of beers with, you know, shoot the shit with, watch a little TV, you know, that kind of thing, have a conversation with. With him, I don't know that I would feel very comfortable doing that after a while.
Okay, so, my story.
Yes, I want to hear this.
This film came out in 2015. We started in 2010.
Yeah.
And one of the first interviews we did, Vidal's partner Howard Austin had passed away.
Yes.
They'd closed up the house in Italy. Vidal was up in years. He would die within about 18 months or 2 years.
Yeah.
he'd moved back to Los Angeles. We sent a query to see if he would do this interview. Vidal had this policy, basically, two things you never say no to are sex and appearing on television. So,
Diana, two things you never say no to. I'm going to hold you to that. The appearing on television part.
I got a question for you. I'll ask her about that.
So we go set up this interview, and we're in his Hollywood Hills mansion in the living room on the, like, it was just a fascinating thing. He was stepsisters with Jackie Kennedy, and there's photos of Jackie Kennedy there. His father's mistress was Amelia Earhart.
Oh, wow.
And there was this classic photo of Amelia Earhart that you've seen a million times in textbooks, but there it was printed from the negative, and it was so intense. Wow. So anyway, the manservant comes in and says, can I bring in Mr. Vidal? We're just about ready, so we say, sure, bring him in. He gets wheeled in a wheelchair, and he won't make eye contact with anyone. And it was weird. It was really awkward. And so someone on the crew pipes up and says, my uncle served in the Aleutian Islands at the same time you did during World War II. And he said he could never get warm. Gore Vidal says,
yeah,
I had my rage to keep me warm. Wow. Okay, man. Here we go. Yeah. Interview. Let's go, buddy.
Let's go.
Just all right. You know,
kind of cranky, but you know.
So it went downhill from there. It did not get any better.
It was horrible.
And after like 2.5 hours, we gave up. It was really frustrating. And Gore was wheeled out, and we're wrapping up. And the manservant comes back in and says, Mr. Vidal would like to know if you'd like to have cocktails with him upstairs. And at that point, we'd have cocktails with anybody. It had been that, you know, we
kind of drink. Yeah.
So we go upstairs, and the manservant says, in here, we thought we were going into a parlor.
Yeah.
It's Gore Vidal's bedroom. Gore Vidal's propped up in bed. He had a bad back. He's propped up in bed on pillows. And he says, boys, take a seat. And we look around. There's no chairs. So we all sat around the edge of
his bed.
Gore Vidal's bed. A cocktail cart was wheeled in, and the charm was totally on. And the thing was that we figured it out later. It's like he couldn't agree with the premise of the film. The premise of the film said, we're not taking sides here about Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley. We're talking about how we fight, not the fight. He said, and so he couldn't agree with the notion that Buckley was going to be on a level playing field with him. He had only disdain for Buckley. So once we weren't talking about that, once we were hanging around in the bedroom shooting the breeze, the charm was on.
Yeah.
If we'd have pulled out the camera,
and you'd have had some gold right
No!
there. He would have shut it down, right?
It would have gone right back to the cantankerous, uneditable answers that he was...
I'm only doing this because I'm told to. That kind of thing.
Yeah. So there's... And then the postscript is, in the film, we don't use any of the interview because when we were in the editing room, we realized Gore had outlived Buckley and wrote this scathing obituary. Really brutal.
Really?
And so it was like he had the last word.
Yeah.
And if we then... And we do a real good job of keeping a balance between the two men in the film because we're not trying to push one over the other. That's
sure.
not what it's about. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how the audiences had such – they took such delight that we didn't pick one over the other.
Yeah, they didn't take sides, yeah.
That and they were so shocked by that we you know, wouldn't push an agenda. That agenda won. Who won?
Yeah,
who,
unlike
– Left or right.
Unlike Frost-Nixon where they kind of – you're sort of led down that road that, you know, Frost was right.
Well, yeah, but it's a different, I mean, there it's sort of a personal thing.
Yeah,
and here these
vendetta,
these two guys are representing, I mean, when I saw the bootleg DVD I saw of the Raw debates.
Yes.
I realized these are the culture wars we live in now. This is left versus right now being articulated in 1968, decades ago, 45 years ago.
Yeah.
Here's our present day augured, anticipated, you know. And so... it would be very easy to take a side and say clearly this side is right and not that side, like politics now, like media now, mm-hmm. like, you know, now you don't get, you know, even the channel you choose is
biased.
Tilted.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to find that middle of the road. Yeah.
So, yeah, so we didn't use any of the interview. Gore got the last word, and the last word is the last word.
And took it with him, too. Yeah. Yeah. That's so much like him. Yeah, that must have been just an absolute fascinating research project to, you know, even in the
You go into these things, you know, you go into making a documentary, and you never know if it's going to take. Like we thought, this is a great idea. This is a fundable idea.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have this out for the 2012 presidential elections.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, here it is. The 2016 presidential elections, and we finally have it done. You go into them and you have to say, can I live with this for a long time? And so when, you know, the idea of having to live with Buckley and Vidal for a long time, I could do that. I'm going to learn something. You know, this is sure. not particularly in my wheelhouse. I really love the history that they command and that they bandy about in their debates. I love their language.
Yeah.
I love, you know,
the personalities that came out of it.
Yeah, so I was like, yeah, if this takes 5 years, okay. There was some harrowing despondent. There was despondent moments in the 5 years. We didn't think we'd get it made. But ultimately, funding came through. And
it's a good labor of love, and there it is.
Yeah. And the response has been phenomenal.
That's great. I'd love to see it. What other film work are you working on that you can get into?
There's a soul singer named John Gary Williams who was vocalist of the Mad Lads, and a friend of mine had been working with him for several years trying to figure out how to make a movie, and so I've stepped in there to help them out because I think that there's a really great, because it's suddenly become current. Mm-hmm. There's an element of cop shooting in it. There's an element of, you know, race. There's an element. There's lots of contemporary stories, and we've kind of cracked a way to tell it. We're working on that now. I'm working with a prominent 80s rock band that's come back around and is finally seeing their day, but I haven't signed any papers with them, so I don't want to name names.
Right.
That I think will happen. And
you probably just got Diana's attention because she loves that genre. it's another weird world there. Yeah.
And that was sort of the post-punk thing. You know, was my college days, and so yeah. I'm into all that. And I wrote that book about Stax, which there's talk of doing some TV work with. And man,
what a beautiful story, man! If you can pull that off,
I'm optimistic. Cautiously optimistic that we'll make that into some kind of limited run TV series.
Would it be like, would you do it as a, like a documentary as opposed to just like an acted out drama?
Acted out drama.
Just a portrayal. With actors.
Written, scripted, proper, you know, it would be, I did a documentary, you know, the book was, before the book I had made the documentary, it was on Great Performances, a 2-hour piece. Probably 2005 or so. I'm guessing, maybe. So yeah, you can find that out there. There's a 1-hour edited version. We had to make a 1-hour version, which was for like foreign TV, and that's on the internet. And I don't endorse it.
Okay,
go get you got to see the 2-hour version.
Yeah, because you don't want to. It's like any guy that cuts their record or their film. Ridley Scott complains to this day about Blade Runner because of that. Cutting it down. You know,
but still, that was an evisceration. It was not an edit. It was just we took the guts got taken out of it. I mean,
are you doing any work? For some reason, I just popped in my head. I don't know if it's true. Are you involved in any of the projects at HBO? The show Vinyl.
No.
That is about the music industry,
right?
Which is kind of a drama portrayal type thing,
right? No.
For some reason, I thought your name had come up in that as maybe a tech advisor or something along those lines.
Bring it on. Bring it on.
You should.
No. I went out there and pitched with a guy, me and a guy from Memphis named Ido Pat.
Yeah.
Had an idea, and we worked it up as a sort of a, you know, rock and roll distribution story. And went out there and pitched it, and they were pretty much moving forward with the vinyl thing at that point.
And I got you. Yeah.
We were the story that didn't get told. Okay. One of the stories that didn't get told.
Well, maybe not yet. Maybe.
Exactly. It's a story. My kids keep going, you know, that's a good story. When are you going to do that one?
Well, someday it probably will. You know, everything is cyclic in this business.
Yeah.
You know how it is.
Yep. Don't throw it away, folks.
No.
File it.
And as far as writing, as a working writer, you're constantly at a keyboard probably. And, you know, you got a story you're working on now?
I've been approached to collect my essays or collect some essays. So
Avril just got excited.
So, yeah, because that's kind of cool. So many of the magazine pieces I did, you know, I was the guy who would come along and everybody would be shouting, you know, I want to do the cover. And it was always in my day when it was when magazines were still printed and there wasn't the web.
Right.
You know, the cover stories were always like Michael Jackson, Madonna, and Prince. That was always seemed to be the cover story. And I never wanted to write that story.
That was a month of Rolling Stone that you just described right there.
Yeah.
Rolling Stone magazine, that's all it was.
Yeah, for years.
For years.
And so I'd let all them yell and scream for that, and then they'd all go away. And I'd approach the editor and go, because I knew he had to fill the rest of the magazine.
Yeah.
And I didn't mind being in the back. I would say, hey, I'm interested in doing this piece on, you know, James Carr or Furry Lewis or Jim Dickinson, you know, and they would be, oh yeah, that's that Southern stuff. Okay, that'll look good in the magazine. You do it, you know. And so I got to tell. I would just went from magazine to magazine to magazine, and I would just tell my stories. And so
as a freelancer,
yeah.
So you're just coming in to fill, give them space to fill, and be done with it.
And some cred, they get a little cred from it.
You know,
they feel like, oh yeah, we cover it all.
Oh yeah, we have the Jim Dickinson story over here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I was like, oh, these are my, you know, and I would pour my heart out into these, and it was good. I'd get good play, and people knew to look for it. People who weren't interested in the Michael Jackson cover knew that in the back of the magazine, sometimes there was something interesting.
Yeah.
So I would be that guy giving that interesting stuff. And so now I'm going to collect some of them, and I'm going to write new introductions to them and compile them.
That'll be a great read.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it'll bring those.
I got a title for you, too.
Yeah.
Rent Party.
Rent Party.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Oh, I shouldn't have said it. Now it'll be stolen. Mine. I called it.
No, it's copywritten here. We'll give it over to you. Just by virtue of it airing, it's yours.
Yeah.
I've been to a few of those in town.
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah. So I got that going. And that's kind of the writing project. Oh, well, the other film thing I have going is I have a narrative feature, a scripted story with actors, you know, that I'm almost done with.
Yeah.
And that I want to try and shoot here in town. And I like that because it, again, is I've done so much music stuff. This is a non-music thing, although I want to score it with Jerry Lee Lewis.
Yeah.
And it would be something new. I haven't done scripted film.
Oh, yeah.
Documentary is the opposite. It's the inverse of
because there's no script. You barely have an outline,
feature,
right? Yeah,
you write it. You know, you write your script and you get your actors and you go shoot it. And you go in the editing room and you assemble it from your script.
Mm-hmm.
But in a documentary, you go shoot, and then you go in the editing room and you make your script.
Yeah,
you know, you make your story in there. So, be interesting to work it. It seems so much easier to do the scripted thing, and I can tell you the documentaries are hard.
I've heard that before.
And the others pay better.
Oddly enough. Look, whatever we can do to help you out in any of your projects, so you know we're pretty connected as well here. I mean, we can hook you up with a lot of folks that are probably willing to help you out along the way as well.
Cool.
Your book's all available in the usual outlets.
Buy local if you can. Buy local. Buy from an independent.
Burke's Books,
Laurel.
Yeah, the Laurelwood. Yeah.
Booksellers of Laurelwood, anywhere, you know. If you can't find it locally, you can find it online.
Yeah.
They're all out there. Now they're all in paperback as well. So some are still, the Stacks book's still available in hardback. And I have this documentary that hardly ever gets, that is way under the radar, called Very Extremely Dangerous, and it's it came out through Fat Possum. It's a DVD and a CD. Here, can I have you play a track?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we can do that.
This is play the first one. This is a documentary about a outlaw who steals the... I made a documentary from William Eggleston's 1970s video footage.
Yeah.
And this guy steals the movie and almost steals Eggleston's life. And so I'd looked for him for years and years, and then a friend of mine found him. And so my friend was a filmmaker, and we went... This guy had just gotten out of prison, his third term in a state prison,
yeah,
under an assumed name. How's that?
Okay.
To pull that off.
That's a trip.
Isn't that amazing?
God.
So he was on the bench. The only thing separating him from freedom was the last door. He's sitting there, and he was serving under the name Billy Thurman. And his real name is Jerry McGill, which actually isn't his real name. And the
it's like Catch Me If You Can.
This guy's all messed up.
The screw pops the door open and says, "Thurman, who's Jerry McGill?" And McGill is like inches, seconds from freedom.
Yes.
And he goes, "Oh, that's my BMI name. That's the name I write songs under." Like, had it like that.
Oh, no.
He goes, "Okay, you can go." Man, the guy was almost busted as he was leaving the pen. So we found him. So he'd just gotten out of jail. He had just reconnected with his girlfriend from his teenage days, and he had just found out he had lung cancer. And we met him at that moment in time and hung with him over 10 weeks on this carousel that kept going faster and faster until it became an untenable roller coaster ride that we had to leap off of. And then we went in the editing room and
made the story.
This film, and it's called Very Extremely Dangerous, and you can get it as a download from iTunes, or get the... I recommend the package from Fat Possum because it's very pretty, and it's got the DVD and the CD
and the soundtrack,
which this is actually a combination. It's a soundtrack, and he has lost more master recordings than most people ever get to make. And so these were about 10 tracks we salvaged over time.
Wow.
And this one is a version of the Guy Clark song, Desperado's Waiting on a Train. It features Mudboy and the Neutrons, my all-time favorite Memphis band, in what is possibly their greatest ever
performance. Yeah.
Dickinson always said, the best songs don't get recorded, the best recordings don't get released, the best releases don't get played. And so this is like the epitome of that, although it has finally gotten out, it's, and you're going to play it. So,
this will be we'll a first.
But check out the guitar here. It's Lee Baker from Mudboy and the Neutrons, and it sounds like he's playing barbed wire.
Okay, cool. All right, well, let's check it out right here on Radio Memphis.
Sit there in the kitchen, Lord, and cry. Run his fingers through 70 years of living. Wonder why his every well ran dry. I was just a kid. He always called me sidekick.
like desperados waiting for a train. Time that I could walk, he took me with him, just drinking beer and playing 42. He taught me how to drive his car when he is too drunk to, and he'd laugh and give me money for a girl. And our lives was like some old Western movie, like desperados waiting for a train. Day before he died, I went to see him. I was grown, he was almost gone. We closed our eyes, remembering the time. Sang another verse of this old song. Look out, old man. The son of a bitch is coming.
Desperado's waiting for a train. Desperado's waiting for a train. Desperado's waiting for a train.
There you go, from Very Extremely Dangerous. Who is that again?
Jerry Maguille.
Jerry Maguille
is the and I'm putting air quotes around this, his real name.
But what a fantastic story.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to see this film, Very Extremely Dangerous.
Yeah.
And it's available where sold.
Yes.
As it were. So, yeah, but get the package.
It's handsome.
With the DVD and the seat on there. Yeah, that's going to be on my list of things to get my hands on.
Here's what's coming up on the next episode with Rick Cheddar from Radioland.
You know, when Steven Tyler released a country tune, well, there were people who, oh, you know, it was pretty good. No, it sucked. And I was the only one that said it. So it kind of made me feel like, at the time, I was the only one that said it. I said, you know, at the time, it kind of made me feel what the hell are you talking about, Rick? You know, everybody else likes it. No, you like Steven Tyler. You don't like the fact that the song that he did was just garbage. You're afraid to admit that because you don't want to cease to be popular amongst your peers. So with me, I could give a shit. So I came out right out and I said it. I said it out loud. It sucks. And ultimately, people were coming up to me going, yeah, Rick, you're right. It does. It blows. But come on, say it out loud. You're not hurting anybody's feelings by speaking your mind, and that's just it.
Rick Cheddar from Radioland is produced by Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. You can subscribe to the show through iTunes, Player.fm, TuneIn, and Stitcher. You can also listen online and download past episodes at radio-memphis.com.
I love the fact that you're shipping out the Memphis sound, the diverse Memphis sound to the world. You know, that's a great thing to have it.
It's important.
In a concentrated place.
Yeah, we have people that have discovered us quite literally from around the world that look specifically for Memphis music. And it's not just the Stack sound. It's not just, you know,
right.
Sun or you know, the Phillips stuff.
Okay, you know. Sorry, man, I'm not gone yet.
Okay,
you're not
good.
Kicking me out.
No.
I got
one
more CD to
All right, no, that's fine.
I'm going to leave you this one, too. This is called The Ghost of Stax Past.
Okay.
And you can hear this on my website, the Robert Gordon. Okay, so here's the deal here.
First track, all tracks?
No, let's go. Yeah, all tracks. Let's go to, let me find something funky. You don't mind playing something funky, right?
You play whatever you want. This okay. This is your time, man.
Let's go to track 21, just to make it hard for you.
You're not.
So the deal here is they were tearing down stacks in 1989. I had moved back to Memphis in 1988. And so I drove by the building just to kind of bid farewell. And I pulled around back, and the Cyclone fence had been breached. And I'd never been inside stacks. I was like, oh, wow, I can go under the fence and go inside. And they'd already begun to tear it down, and they'd put a stop work order on it. So no one was there. And there was no back wall on the building, and the fence protecting it was open. So I was like, hell, I'm going in. And I go in, and, you know, once I stepped a few feet in, it was really dark, and I had to go back out and dig in the – pull the seat out of my Volkswagen and find a pack of matches under the seat, literally. And also, I didn't know that the stop work was because of a gas leak.
Oh, no.
Nice going, Indiana Jones.
boom. So I'm going around there lighting these matches, opening doors. You know, I'd never been in the building. I open a closet door, and I look down, and there's tapes. So I picked up the box of tapes. It turned out there was two boxes of tapes.
Yeah, you're rescuing them, yeah.
I picked them up, and I brought them outside. Me and this other guy, and I'm looking at them, and I'm, you know, and they've got salamanders on them. They're wet, muddy. I was like, hell no, I'm not throwing them away. And so over time, as I would cover recording sessions for magazines, I would be in recording studios, and I'd get the tapes transferred. They were all quarter-inch tapes.
Mm-hmm.
And so then this, The Ghost of Stacks Past, is a collection of the best stuff.
Of that stuff that you pulled out of there?
Yeah. Oh, wow. And so what a lot of it is songwriting demos. And a lot of it is, I think, they would, you know, they were a neighborhood place, Stacks was. And on they got so many people coming in there to say, hey, I want to be a star, that they started saying, Saturday mornings between, I think, 9 and noon, come by. We have an open, we can't stop what we're doing every day to audition people from the street, but you come in Saturday mornings, we're set up to hear you. So some of these tapes, like this track I'm going to play you, I think is someone who came in on a Saturday morning and said, you know, here's what we can do. We're kids in the neighborhood.
This was their audition.
This is their audition. And so I've...
And you don't even know who it is, do you?
No. So that's why I've put it on the internet. If I can identify all of these people are, and who wrote the songs, then I can legally put it out. Up to that point, I can't release it. So search The Ghost of Stacks Past, and this will come up, and you can kind of check these out. And some of them I've identified, and you'll see.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, so this is a song, what did we say, 21?
Yeah.
Terrible Thing. And on it says, audition for Alan Jones. That was on the tape box. Alan Jones was the Barquet's producer.
So Alan was behind the... He
was not... So these were people who came in and said, we want Alan to hear us.
Oh, I got you. It was for Alan to hear.
Yeah.
I got you. Okay. All right. Well, here, let's check it out.
Go ahead. Take one. Love is dream.
Love is dream. Away. Whoa, no love. Yes,
Yeah, there you go. The ghost of Stax Past, we don't really know who that was.
Yeah, Love is Strange. They have two songs on there. I think I introduced as Terrible Thing. That's the other one. Yeah. This is Love is Strange, yeah. How about it, man? That's what would happen in Stax on a Saturday morning. You know, hey, you guys, come on, go. Here's your time. We're going to hit record now. Go.
And what a kind of a cool concept, though, if you think about it.
Yeah, oh, my God.
Because you didn't know what was going to happen. You didn't know what was going to happen.
They happened because Rufus Thomas walked in the front door. So they were thereafter the front door was always open. Otis Redding walked in the front door. You know, They kept the front door open there.
Good thing. And then a lot of times, and unfortunate as this may be, you'll see a band that come together, they got their shit together, they sound great, they're really good. They put out their first EP and then they're gone just like that.
Break up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know? Well, it's a tough world, you know. Yeah. You get out there and you start to get in it and you realize, wait a minute, I'm going to sign up for 45 more years of this. You know? I mean,
dang.
Yeah.
You know? No, I mean, you know.
Yeah, that's what
it takes.
Is.
It takes, it's the rare breed that can make it last. You know.
Through the thick and the thin. It's a marriage, yeah.
Yeah. I'm amazed. I think part of the luck I've had is just kind of that I've been able to still be standing, you know, still here when attendance was taken.
Yeah.
Well, because so many people couldn't make it, you know, for one reason or another, economics or drugs or whatever, you know,
right.
people fade and so the crowd thins and, you know, I was in a lot of the right places at the right time and that helped, but.
Well, keep doing it. Sounds like you're on the right. You're still on the right path. Keep writing.
Oh, thank you, sir. I shall.
Yes, I want to see these films. I'm dying to see Best of Enemies. Did it show? Did it even play here?
It did not get a theatrical release. It was.
I can make that happen.
Okay.
I think I can make that happen.
Okay. Yeah. Let's do it.
Seriously,
let's
we can do. We can do. We can do a big red carpet thing. I know people. We can do a thing. Yeah. In fact, if we hurry, we can get the date that we had. We'll talk about that. We can make some stuff happen here.
All right. I'm all ears.
All right. Thank you so much, Robert.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Thanks very much for having me on. Thanks,
anytime.
Good to meet you.
Absolutely.
Good to meet you.
The proceeding was produced by Pirate Radio Studios, Incorporated, Memphis, Tennessee. For more audio on demand, go to radio-memphis.com.